Today is Tuesday, December 17th, 2013. This is Pauline Adams, and I am interviewing Nina Silberglite. That's my typing for me. House manager, among other things, at Wharton Center. What is Wharton Center? Its origin, its role, etc., here at Michigan State.
Wharton Center is my home. I've been there for 30 years, and I'm very passionate about it. And what Wharton Center is the really cultural center in many ways for Michigan State University. It was developed in thought by Clifton and Dolores Wharton, among many others who were on campus during the 1970s. And they felt very strongly, the Whartons, about the arts being a very humanizing factor in people's lives. And while there was a university auditorium where we were doing performances, and prior to that, my understanding is that the university had a long-standing relationship with the arts, and we're doing things at People's Church and many other places prior to the auditorium. But the Whartons wanted to build a performing arts center, a world-class performing arts center on the campus that would bring in even more bigger and universal kind of activities, events. So this is all prior to my time coming to the university. And they started the fundraising projects, worked with numerous people through the university and the community, got the fundraising project going. And in 1978, 79, I believe, they broke ground and started building Wharton Center. Wharton Center opened in September of 1982. And all of us who were working at the university auditorium moved over to the Wharton Center. And that was the beginning of a really tremendous asset to the university. So not only does Wharton Center bring in performances, everything from ballet to dance to music, the biggest mission is really education and sharing what these cultural opportunities can do for humanity. So that's primarily what Wharton Center is. It's really an educational center that happens to be under the guise of a performing arts center.
Well, great. I think you've answered several questions I have in the future, but I may come back to them nevertheless. Now, what does your role as house manager at Wharton Center involve?
So the house manager, when people ask me what's a house manager, I tell people it's like Wharton Center is my home, and I do an awful lot of entertaining. So the house manager is in charge of everything that the public sees. So, you know, basically a house manager would be the person who's responsible for getting people into their seats safely at a performance and making sure that everything happens in a timely fashion as it should for the patrons who are arriving at Wharton Center. Behind the scenes, we do a lot more.
So you, for instance, would be in charge of hiring the ushers?
Yes. I used to be the person who did all the hiring, but now one of our assistant house managers does all the hiring. And we employ over 150 students at a time in house management alone. Then we have other departments that I also operate where we employ students. So just in house management altogether, I think there's probably about 180-plus students.
Wow. Now, are any of the ushers employed permanently? I mean, come back all the time?
Well, I just wrote an article for our Beyond the Stage and talked a little bit about the house management family because my background is that I was walking across campus in probably 1979, and a friend of mine said, I'm going to sign up to be an usher at the auditorium. And I said, oh, sounds like fun. I'll do it too. And that's when I started working for Ken Beechler and then moved over to Wharton Center. So I would say that the majority of ushers that we hire spend their entire college career working for us. They don't leave. They like the job. It's really the best job on campus. You get paid to see performances. And and many people go to grad school maybe so they can continue working at Wharton Center till they figure out what they really want to do. And several of those people, myself included, end up staying. So I started and was studying something completely different.
And we'll get to that in a minute.
Ended up becoming the full-time house manager. My two assistant house managers both worked for me, left and did other things, and then came back and are working. And our newest person in our department is Lauren Selinsky, and she also was a student for us and wanted to stay. And her fiance is going to the College of Osteopathic Medicine, and so this was a great location for her to be, and she's with us. We've had several marriages out of the group, so, you know, it really is a very close-knit group, and everybody loves the job and likes to stay.
Well, that speaks very highly for the morale there, certainly. Well, before we discuss in greater detail your activities and duties as house manager, let us go back to your earlier life. Tell us a little about your childhood, things like where you were born, where you grew up, your siblings and parents, etc.
Okay. I was born in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. And while my father was a resident at the University of Minnesota Hospital, we left shortly after I was born and moved to Wichita, Texas, Wichita Falls, where I tell people I learned to walk and talk. So I'm a little bit Texan. And he was in the Air Force there, and then we moved to Michigan really before I started school. So my life pretty much is as a Michigander. And growing up, my parents were very active in the arts. So my mother was constantly taking us to the Detroit Institute of Arts, to the theater in Detroit. We grew up just outside of Detroit. And so I recall my childhood being full of the arts, whether it was performances. Our neighborhood was full of symphony people from the Detroit Symphony. My best friend's father was first trumpet in the Detroit Symphony, so we were always going down with him and going backstage. And I was a violinist for a number of years, a ballerina for a number of years. So the arts are a serious part of me. But I was also very athletic, so I wanted to be the best darn gym teacher you could possibly be, so I came to Michigan State because of their phenomenal kinesiology department. So I have siblings, two brothers. As I mentioned, my father's a physician, so the rest of the boys in the family, went to medical school, so I'm the girl in the middle. Older brother's a doctor, younger brother's a doctor, father's a doctor, mother and daughter are in the arts.
A well-rounded family.
Exactly.
Well, tell us a little about your college education, of things like where and when and what you majored in.
So I came to Michigan State University in 1978, and it was my ambition to become a gym teacher. And because I always thought that the gym teachers that I had always focused on sports and competition. And that's not what I was into. I was into people enjoying being physical and enjoying their bodies. And so I wanted to be a gym teacher with a different kind of appeal. I wanted to reach out to kids and make sure that everybody felt comfortable doing some type of activity. And so I came to Michigan State, great department, made a lot of really great friends. Quickly, I realized that I was missing the arts part of my life. And so I also started a degree in art education and was a studio artist and really fell in love with art history. And so that was really the degree I got for fun. And I still thought that my kinesiology degree was going to be my profession. But then I went to do my student teaching. And while I loved working with the kids, I was not particularly fond of the administration in the public schools.
Where did you do your teaching?
At Gardner Middle School. I think it was Gardner Junior High at the time in Lansing.
Oh.
And we had I had a phenomenal experience there. The kids were terrific. It was a little challenging and a little sad because some of the kids would just disappear and they would move to be with another parent and then they would come back. But I built some really nice relationships with my students, and because we weren't really doing competitive sports, I wasn't the kind of gym teacher who threw out a basketball and said, "Here, play." But this was really before aerobics started coming into the world, and before people were doing aerobics classes or dance classes, but that's what I was doing. So we started dancing, and boys, girls, everybody could do it. Everybody had fun. You turned on some music, and we started being invited to perform at malls. And so that was a great experience for the kids. So I loved doing the student teaching. I just didn't think that I could do it long term. And I really learned a lot about and learned a lot to respect other teachers and people who could do it, because it's very hard work and so incredibly important. But I decided, because again, it was at the beginning of something called corporate fitness, and Tom Monahan was building Domino's Farms, and he was putting in the first gym at the headquarters. And I thought, well, that's me. I'm going to be a personal trainer. And so I started working on my graduate degree. And but I was working at Wharton Center the entire time. And when I was close to finishing my graduate degree, I decided that the arts were really what I was going to focus on. So I left and went applying for jobs in the arts. Had two people who were interested in me. And at that same time, I got a phone call from Wharton Center that said, "Before you take another position, we would like to have you interview for the full-time position of house manager at Wharton Center." So I came back, and I've been there ever since.
Well, you've answered my next three questions, which is great. And I want to congratulate you about deciding to leave teaching. I myself am passionate about teaching, just as you are about Wharton Center. But I don't want anyone in the profession who isn't passionate
Correct.
About teaching.
Yes.
So I think you made a very wise decision, not only for yourself, but for the profession as well.
Yes, thank you.
And you've been working here over 30 years, you said.
Yes. So full-time, I started in 1985, but I count my student years. So at Wharton Center, it was 82 to 85, and prior to that, it was at the auditorium. But I start counting at the Wharton Center years because I really helped to develop a lot of the programs that are still in place today.
So let's delve more deeply into your responsibilities at House Manager. Now, you said that everything that appears before the public is what you are in charge of. Which of all those multiple duties do you find most challenging, and why?
Well, that's an interesting question. So back to the teaching, one of the things that I've always enjoyed about the position and, the thing that most people are aware of that we do is the ushering.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like such a simple thing. And I used to tell the ushers when they first started working that, you know, this is not brain surgery. This is a very simple job. Essentially, you smile at people, greet them, and offer to help them find their seat. Over the last 25 years, customer service. See,
welcome to the club.
So customer service has become a very difficult thing to provide for people.
Why?
I ask myself that question all the time. So two things have happened. One is people have changed what their expectations are, and students have changed in what not only what their expectations are for their own customer service, but also how they associate with other people. So just last night I was talking to my book club members, and we got on the topic of younger people and, civility, really, how people treat people. And so I think that's changed greatly. I was telling them that I got a letter from some patrons who were very disturbed by some other members of the audience and how they were acting during a performance. They were talking, they were crackling wrappers, they were taking out their phones and texting. And obviously when I started, everybody wasn't carrying a cell phone. Doctors used to come and check their pagers in my office, and we would go and get them if they had to be reached. Babysitters would call, and we would pass notes down through the rows to reach people. Now people take out their cell phones all the time. So that's really changed. So what I've always focused on in my role, and so the primary part of my job is really to teach the ushers what their responsibilities are. And those responsibilities continue to grow as people start doing these other behaviors and bringing them with them wherever they go. And to teach patrons. So this couple wrote me a letter and said that they were really disappointed and wasn't at our usher's job to stop people from, you know, using their cell phones and opening candy wrappers and making them sit still. And, you know, it's difficult to explain to people, but, and these people said, you know, we think we're going to stop being donors and we're going to stop coming. And so it took me about 3 days to write the letter because I went through many different moods about how I felt and how I would respond to them. But in the end, I said to them, I really hope that you will continue your patronage and that you will help set an example for the other people in the audience by your good behavior. We will continue to do the best that we can do and look for these behaviors and try and stop people. But we don't want you to stop coming. So, did I answer your question?
Yes, I can see why that would be the most challenging of your. Now, I understand about the behavior of the audience, which has changed markedly because, in part, of the advancement of technology. Now, do you find that the ushers themselves are different than they were, say, 30
Absolutely.
Years ago?
Absolutely.
In what way?
Absolutely. Well, several different things. So first and foremost, when we started, when I was doing the bulk of the hiring, most students had some previous work experience. And now a lot of the students come to Michigan State and have never worked, ever. They've done a lot of volunteerism, they've done projects, but they've never held a job before. So our first part of the work is to teach them what a job is and explain to them, you know, you're responsible for showing up when you need to. You're responsible for following our rules. You're responsible for wearing a uniform, all of these things. And so that's number one, is just working with people who have never had prior work experience. Number two is getting people to stop talking and to listen. So, as I said, we've tried a lot of different things, and we do a whole new training program now that we have to keep changing in order to train people. So one of the things, and I'll tell the story through an example. A couple years ago, I was reading a kind of a training manual and from Zingerman's, and they had something called the 10-4 rule. And it's not a rule that they made up. It's a well-known kind of management tool. And they said that the 10-4 rule is when somebody is 10 feet away from you, you should engage them visually. So you should look them in the eye as they're walking towards you. And at 4 feet, you should say hello to them. Be the first to speak. And so we said, okay, let's put this into practice. And everybody said, okay. So they started doing it. And a couple days later, I started asking, how's it going? You know, is it working? And they said, yeah, it really works with people your age, but it doesn't work with people our age. And I said, why is that? Why do you think that is? And they said, well, first of all, they're not looking up. So you can't engage them because their eyes are looking down. And I said, well, why are their eyes looking down? And they said, well, they're usually walking in with their phones. And I went to another meeting, and this was explained to me that they're called the belly button generation because they're always looking down with their phones in their hands. So they're looking towards their belly button. So that's how they're referred to in a lot of management training courses, is dealing with the belly button generation. So we said, So that was interesting. It was eye-opening for the students. So they started recognizing some behavior and said, you know, what can we do? So they've adapted the rule a little bit, and they wait for them to get much closer, and then they say hello. And then the younger people are often startled and look up and say, wow, that was nice. Somebody said hello to me and smiled. So we've always said that, you know, you can come to work at Wharton Center and you can be in a terrible mood. But the thing is that a smile is part of your uniform. And when you start smiling at people, they start smiling back. And by the end of a work period, everybody feels much better. So
what do you, to go back to the example you used before, the letter you got complaining about, what do you tell your ushers to do about a patron in the audience who is a problem? How do you instruct your ushers to deal with them?
Well, it depends on the problem. It depends on when it's happening. Because at Wharton Center, due to the continental seating without the center aisles, which is a very good thing, I like to talk about what's good about it. It does present some problems, such as getting to a difficult patron or somebody who's causing problems. So it's interesting because you can actually stand at the end of the row and just stand and look towards the difficult patron, and most of the time, people start to feel that energy of somebody staring in that direction. And that usually is an effective way of getting people to stop. Sometimes you have to stand there a long time and keep the pressure up. But other times we do go into a row and take cameras, take cell phones. Or the probably the best way of dealing with it is encouraging our patrons to let us know when somebody's bothering them, hopefully at intermission, and then we will go in and speak to the patron. And often it's the patron who was being having the offense upon them that we end up moving, and hopefully to a similar type seat. But that seems to work much better than trying to deal with a difficult patron.
It can be a problem. Well, what would you say is the most rewarding of your responsibilities? And you talked about the most challenging. What is the most rewarding of those responsibilities and why?
Well, I have always told people that I have the best job in the world. And the reason is that I am passionate about the arts. I like people. And I like all the students who work for us. It's close to being a teacher without being a teacher, because I do get to essentially mentor these people, especially since they stay with me for 4 years, many of them. And so I get to see a change in them. What was the question?
What is the most rewarding. Responsibility.
So for me, even though I keep regular business hours, I'm one of the few staff members, other than the backstage people, who are there when the performances actually take place. And that's what we're all there working towards. Well, I get to see the fruit of the labor. I get to see the patrons coming, and I've developed relationships with most of our audience and people in the community. And it's fun for me to first welcome them to Wharton Center and then to be able to discuss the performance after. Did you like it? Did you not like it? What didn't you like about it? And I'm very passionate about that, whether I like the performance or not. And then to see how the performances affect our students. Because many of the people, and most people assume that the students who work for us are people who are already interested in the arts, and that couldn't be further from the truth. The majority of the students have just heard word of mouth from somebody that it's a good job. And so they come, they have no idea what they're getting themselves into, and they become patrons of the arts after they leave. And they're surprised when they watch something and they're like, oh, I had no idea what this show was about and I loved it. Or it opens up a conversation for them like it does for me. That's very rewarding. And when now I have students who had worked for us who come back and tell me, oh, Nina, you won't believe there's this great performing arts center where I live. I go all the time. I'm a donor. And that really means something to me.
Oh, I can understand that. What role does the gift shop play at Wharton Center? What is its history?
So Wharton Center had a gift shop almost from the very beginning. And, you know, Wharton Center has grown a great deal. I should say that when Wharton Center first opened, there were 3 to 5 full-time staff people. But the bulk of the responsibilities were handled by students and volunteers. So the volunteers were the most critical part of the beginning of Wharton Center, and to this day still are, very, very important. And so the gift shop actually was developed very early on, if not the first year, within the first 3 years. And it was developed like a museum shop. So the idea behind the gift shop was to have merchandise that helped you to, you know, continue your relationship with the arts by taking a gift home that made you think of your experience at Wharton Center, that expanded the experience. So maybe a book on a certain composer, artistic kind of things, creative, that, you know, helped you with the process of art, creativity, and all the, its different forms. So that's how the gift shop started. And it had, it was a bit of a roller coaster ride. You know, that it was off the beaten track. People didn't know that it existed in the early years because you had to go through a series of doors to get to it. Our second executive director had an architectural background, and he said, there must be things we can do to this building for our ever-expanding programs and staff. And so he was very creative and got some blueprints from Michigan State and found a way to move the gift shop. And so it was right off the main corridor. It was completely run by volunteers. They did all the buying, all the accounting. Essentially what I did from the early days was deposit the money, and but they did everything else. And all the staffing and marking. So in 2008, we did another expansion to Wharton Center, or our first expansion, which meant moving the ticket office, which desperately needed to be moved. And in the addition, there was space for a very much expanded gift shop. And so at the time, we decided that we needed to take a little bit more of a responsibility with the store. And it seemed like a natural fit for my department. And so I started researching museum shops, performing arts center stores. I went out to the Los Angeles, to the Walt Disney Hall and the LA Philharmonic store. And the woman there became my mentor, told me to join something called the Museum Store Association. And really, that's what we are. We are a museum store. Wharton Center isn't a museum per se, but it is a nonprofit performing arts center. So like the Detroit Symphony, the LA Philharmonic, nonprofits, where the mission of the store is to continue and expand the mission of the facility that you are in.
So it's doing well now?
It's doing very well.
Great.
Yes.
Great. What would you say was the high point or high points of your career so far?
High points. High points are often also low points in some ways.
And I was going to follow my question with the low points. Of course, I wouldn't have one without the other.
Well, I would say one of the most interesting and challenging things that we did was the 1992 presidential debate. And being the host facility for that, it was challenging for the entire university. There were a lot of people involved. But I have some great memories and a lot of questions about how these debates happen. So one of my best memories is going to meetings with the Secret Service. We had daily meetings with them at 7 a.m., and I'm more of an evening person, not a morning person. The person who was running the meetings had big, bushy eyebrows, and he could raise one at a time and would ask questions and look at you through one eyebrow. And then I remember it was a long process. It was fascinating. It was a great experience for the students who were working for us at the time, because they got to sit in and pretend that they were the different presidents, and this was, or candidates. And this is when, of course, we had Ross Perot. So there were three people in the debate. So it was 92. It was Bush, Clinton, and Ross Perot. And so it was just a fascinating experience for all of us, because Bush had one corridor of the building. Clinton had another corridor. The styles of furniture and amenities that they asked for couldn't have been further apart.
And, can you give us some examples?
Well, so Bush had very traditional, you know, wingback chair, a globe, a big world globe, blues and reds in terms of colors. Clinton's facility was dressed pretty much in leather, black, very contemporary. And Ross Perot got our prop room, and he just had some pipe and drape and a very simple sofa. And so that was very fun to see. You felt like you were walking into different worlds.
So what you did is you assigned different parts of Wharton Center.
Correct.
To each one of
Correct.
The participants.
Correct. So Bush had the entire second floor. Clinton had the third floor, and Ross Perot, as I said, had our prop room storage area. Not very elegant. But he was quite gracious about it. So, as I said, the students got to, they needed to test the mics once the stage was set up. And so the students got to fill in these roles as the people who were asking the questions and as the candidates. So it was a great experience for them and a great experience for us all. It was frustrating because so many people wanted to come, and we were very limited to who could come. And so our balcony pretty much remained empty, which was, I think, the most unfortunate thing about the whole debate, because it would have been a great experience for the students to come. And but they didn't allow that to happen. So
did they give a reason?
Well, what they kept saying was that the debates are really meant to be seen on television. And I think it was a control thing, a safety, security kind of issue. You know, better not to have too many people. So mostly it was the donors and various people who had participated. My regret is that the day of the actual debate, after all this security, and everybody had to have passes and this, that, and tickets, anybody could have gone in, really. I mean, they would have had to go through security, but Gordon Guyer came. And he didn't have his pass with him, even though we know that he was issued one. And so I said to the Secret Service man, what am I supposed to do? And he said, well, do you know him? And I said, yes. And he said, well, let him in. And I said, okay. And I wanted to call my parents at that moment and say, drive up from Detroit. I can let anybody if I know them. So it was interesting. When they came back a couple years later and said, we're considering you for another one, I thought that would be a waste of our time to do another one. We did it. It was a great experience. But the amount of money that we had to raise to host it just seemed like we should be spending it on something else.
So it cost a whole lot to host it.
Yes. The university.
Yes.
Had to pay dearly.
And when you kept saying they allowed this or they said that, the security people?
Well, there were several people. So it's the League of Women Voters who really
sponsored
it. And then, yes, the Secret Service really kind of led the what could happen, what couldn't happen. And so between them, it was arranged, you know, this is our limit number of people who can, who can't. And obviously it wasn't my role to make the guest list. So that came from the president's office. And
by the president, you mean the president of Michigan State?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
I know, because there are so many presidents floating around,
right.
We have to distinguish. Right.
So that was a highlight.
Did the League of Women Voters contribute any money to the...
I'm sure they must have. So I know that I had to turn in a lot of financial documents and things like that. We had to do a lot of estimates. But it was my understanding, and I may have been incorrect in this, that the university or community needed to raise about $500,000.
Yes.
To host.
So you turned down a second chance.
I didn't personally turn down.
I
hoped against hosting another one because I really thought the money in the community could be used for something else. As they said, they being the people who hosted the event, the League of Women Voters and the, you know, security people who were involved, is that it's meant to be a televised event. I did not see what the benefit, other than saying that it's being hosted by Michigan State and all the eyes of the world were on Michigan State for a moment, what the benefit was for the university. I would have liked to see the money, especially a second time, being used for something else.
So that event was both a high point and a low point?
Yes. Yes.
Over the years, there must have been several incidents incidents amusing, instructive, astonishing, perhaps traumatic, that dominate your memories. Could you share some of those with us?
Well, it's there's so many that it's hard to pick and hard to separate them out and to be really clear about any specific event. You know, for me personally, I have my favorite performances where I was not expecting to be overwhelmed to the point of tears about how beautiful or moving something can be that we see on stage. And I have to say that we also host commencements. And that's probably one of the most infuriating and amazing experiences that we
Why?
Do.
Why? Why?
Well, you know, it's human nature, right? So people come for commencement, and students and families are excited and proud. It's never it doesn't change. It's the same. I'm sure my family was like this at all the various graduations that they attended for all of us. But people arrive incredibly early. They're very excited, and everybody wants the best seat in the house. So I tell my ushers to make people stand arm length away from you so that when we open the doors, you know, you don't get crushed and like a rock concert. And when people go across the stage, I always cry, whether it's students I know or people I didn't, and to see how many people get to that point, are the first graduates in their families, the diverse cultures that are represented by students at Michigan State, that always amazes me about the graduations, listening to the commencement speakers. But I have been physically assaulted by family members also.
Why?
Well, one story, which is not a good story, and saddens me whenever I think of it. But one of my roles is also to stay on top of the Americans with Disabilities Act and to make sure that Wharton Center is accessible. So this is a story that has to do with that and your choices of language that you use. So Wharton Center has one entrance, and because of the continental seating again, there's very limited number of seats you can get to without doing some steps. So we have this one area that we now refer to as our mobility access, because it's the only door that you can go in without having to do many steps and get to a wide range of seats. We used to call it our, I'm not sure that we actually had a name for it. We had a wheelchair symbol, but it was our disability access. And so we had a family come to a graduation, and it was a law school graduation. And so we reserved seats for people, but we had we have some extra seats available as well. So there was a family, and because it's limited number of seats, we allow the person with the mobility issue and a companion in. And because at commencements, people can show up with 15 family members. And if we gave 15 seats to people in this mobility access, we wouldn't have the space. So a family shows up, and the husband of one of the family members, who was a brother, I believe, to the person who was graduating, was a veteran and had been amputated in his arm and had a prosthetic hand. And so, and they were there with 10 family members, a baby in a stroller, And we were trying to explain to them that this was a mobility access and that we would be able to keep the whole family together if they went to the back of the theater. And we could put the baby stroller, because they really wanted to stay with the baby, in the stroller. And so we put them on our wheelchair. We offered to put them on our wheelchair platform. Well, the wife of this veteran started screaming at the top of her lungs that she was going to sue me because we were not accommodating them. And so, you know, we tried to explain over and over. And this went on for about 20 minutes. Then they finally agreed to move to the back of the theater and showed them. The husband was fine. He's like, this is great. Thank you very much. The woman kept coming out and just yelling at everybody on my staff and threatening us with a lawsuit. And she said, you know, we have a family of lawyers. I'm like, of course, you're at the law school graduation. But, and, you know, I tried to pull her aside and talk to her, but I'm sure that she was very upset about what had happened to her husband. And, but that was a really unfortunate incident. It really upset a lot of other people who had come for the graduation. And, but graduations just have that kind of emotional intensity. People come so emotionally charged. So I love them. I think they're wonderful experiences. But it's a lot of work and one of my favorite and least favorite things to do. But it's a beautiful facility. And what's so nice is having people come and seeing this beautiful facility and feeling some pride in Michigan State University because they got to have their commencement there, but also because they got their degrees from Michigan State. So I love that part of my job. Performances. I have great stories about performers and terrible stories about performers.
Well, let's hear some.
Well, I don't know that I'm really supposed to name names or anything, but I will.
Good.
So, unfortunately, we had not a very good time with Jerry Lewis. And as a child, I remember watching all the Jerry Lewis movies. We used to sit on Saturday mornings. My older brother and I would just laugh at the Nutty Professor. And so I was really excited to hear that he was coming. And I expected him to be a nice person. And unfortunately, we could not do anything to please him. He was staying in Birmingham. He fired every limo driver that we sent. And so when that happens, when you can't make a performer happy, the audience doesn't get the best performance out of them. They get a little snarky and, you know, people know it. So that was unfortunate. On the other hand, we had Liza Minnelli, and we were given some very specific instructions in dealing with her. And I remember her last performance, she did several performances, and the last performance her manager had said, do not allow her fans to gather at the backstage door. Now, they had been gathering at the backstage door every night, and her fans had come from all over. People came and bought tickets for every performance. And so she came down. And there was really nothing we could do about the fans. And so she saw we had kept them at a little bit more distance than they had been on the other evenings. And she came down and she said, where is everybody? And we said, well, we were told to keep them, you know, out of your way this evening so that you could leave punctually. And so she said, oh, no. She said, please open the door and let them in. And so we did. And I stood there astonished because she knew them by name. And she knew about their families. And she asked them personal questions. And it was it was really touching. It really was amazing to see. So I thought, you know, that is somebody who is extremely gracious. And she was also, as many of the performers are, much shorter. So I pictured her as a dancer and being, you know, at least 5'6". And I think she was probably 5'1" or 2". So like I was surprised at how petite she was. So, and then, of course, there are the stories about the performers who need various things. I had to go down to Detroit to hunt up a certain type of nut for Harry Belafonte. And then, of course, they don't eat any of them. But it's interesting to see what they ask for and learn, you know, who's into the garbage food and who really needs all the healthy stuff. I've gotten very good, though, about these riders and what they ask for and saying, please don't make me waste food. There's nothing I can do because they ask for it to sit out in their dressing room, and we can't give it away after that. So I really work very hard, and it's a big part of my job, the food service part of my job, to ask people not to drink bottled water, but we have water coolers, and to please recycle things and not to throw cans away, not to order food that you're not going to need, or at least, at the very least, take it on your bus with you.
Does it work?
Sometimes. It surprises me knowing that some of these people have these various causes, and then, you know, when it comes to their own, I want it because I can have it, I can ask for it, and you'll get it for me. So that's interesting. But, you know, it's some do, some don't. So it's interesting to see who needs what. And we have Michael McDonald coming up doing a holiday show. And he had a beautiful rider. It was very specific, not over the top. And I want to use it as an example for everybody else. And say, write it this way. So.
What is the role of an institution like Wharton Center in an academic institution?
Well, that's interesting. I remember when I first told my mother that I got this job, and she had said to me, And I think that she had come up to see performances when I was a student usher at the auditorium. And we were kind of amazed that so few students came to performances. And she told me that it was part of her curriculum, that she had to attend performances when she was in college, that they had to attend some performances. So Wharton Center, through the years, has worked very hard to establish relationships with the various departments, to try and tie things into their curriculum. Certainly the MSU-FCU Institute for Arts and Creativity, which is what our art education program is formally called, does that on many different levels.
Could you describe exactly specific departments and what you do specifically with them?
Well, I suppose I can give some examples. So one example would be Bert Goldstein, our director of art education, works very closely with the College of Osteopathic Medicine.
Oh.
And using the PIMSLR program, please don't ask me to describe that, but they believe very strongly in having a doctor in the doctors in the family. I know this to be true, that the arts and sciences go very much hand in hand, that a lot of the top physicians are also great musicians. And also, I think that what I believe the College of Osteopathic Medicine is hoping is, again, going back to the Wharton's philosophy about the arts teaching us some, bringing us closer to humanity, that the arts help to humanize us. And so people think, well, scientists, they're cold, they are very focused on what they find when they do experiments. And so, I think that this combination of bringing the arts and the sciences together teaches us both things. So that's one area. Then we do the Worldview Lecture Series, which grew out of the College of Arts and Letters Celebrity Lecture Series. And now when we do that, we go directly to various departments and say, who from your field would be a good speaker that we could bring to the university? So we're very active with the Residential College for Arts and Humanities, working with them to bring speakers. We've worked with the College of Engineering to bring speakers. So that's a really wonderful program. We also work with the Lansing Intermediate, Ingham Intermediate School District to look at their curriculum, and our director of education looks at booking programs that fit that curriculum. So not just with Michigan State, but with the local school districts as well. Mm-hmm.
In the course of your work, do you interact with any other units of the university aside from the academic units?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, the provost office for the graduations, the College of Arts and Letters, the theater department, you said other than academics, Spartan Signature Catering, you know, physical plant, now infrastructure planning and something. And yes, we're very dependent on other departments around the university to fulfill our job.
Do you interact with any other units? You did mention this interacting with the community at large, educational work. In any other way, have you interacted with the larger community beyond the academic and university?
Yeah, we work with people routinely. So through our advisory council, one of the members of our advisory council was a volunteer for the Schneider campaign. And so when Schneider was elected governor, the friend, the advisory council member said, we have to do an inaugural gala. And what about doing it at Wharton Center? So, of course, Schneider is from Ann Arbor and a U of M grad, was not known to be a big art supporter. So this volunteer for Wharton Center did a fabulous thing by suggesting Wharton Center as the venue for the inaugural gala, which came to be. So that was, I won't say what my, you know, personal preference was, but it was an amazing experience to be able to do that event and have all the people who were affiliated with the Schneider campaign and government come to Wharton Center for the evening, and they were absolutely thrilled with the event, as far as I understood. So we work a lot with the local government. We work with, you know, any organization who wants to. We recently did a fundraiser for the Volunteers of America. So we work with the community a lot in doing various events. People can use our facilities. So not just the university, but the facility itself is open to the public to host events, fundraisers. We do a lot with the community reads and various other events. So, you know, a lot of people think of Wharton Center as someplace that they have to get dressed up to come, that they have to do this, that, and the other thing. And we just really want to encourage people to walk in the door and learn about the facility itself and all there is to it has to offer. So,
if you had unlimited resources, What would be your top choices as how to use them?
Unlimited resources within my profession at Wharton Center. What would you use? What would I do? One thing that I would do was, you know, we're talking, as you said, December, and I just saw a story on the news about a wealthy businessman who walks around giving $100 bills to people. And what I would do is put tickets in the hands of people who think that they can't afford to come to Wharton Center and get them in and let them experience any of the events that we do, whether it's a Wharton Center presentation, a College of Music, a theater department. If they, you know, I would say to them, you know, what would you like, and just be able to hand them a ticket to it. And because I think once people experience something that they have not previously experienced, it might change their opinion about coming and how the arts may affect their life. I would also like to do some more collaboration and bring in some other acts that we currently don't bring in because they might be too financially challenging. Because our audience may not know and choose not to come because they don't know and about a certain act. And I would like to do something like Jim Lawton from the art department brought in something called the Fringe Festival, where we had really performance artists who came in and not only did their performance, but they also did workshops and lectures. And financially, it was very challenging. But I think that along with the Broad Art Museum, the time is right to do a little bit more of that avant-garde experimental kind of art, performance art. So I would work on building a program like that. That's what I would do.
Are there any other aspects of your life at Michigan State, or even life in general, that you would care to share with us?
Was he telling us? Almost up. Well, I've enjoyed my life in East Lansing, and I shouldn't say this. While I love the students, I also love the summer when campus kind of clears out a little bit and I feel like I have a park in my backyard. And I love taking advantage of that park and walking my dog along the Red Cedar River. And it's a little less challenging than when the students are rushing about. So it is a beautiful campus. And I feel that the students, they should all be going to summer school because they're missing Michigan State when it's at its most beautiful. And I've met phenomenal people in my life, not only the students, but the friends and people I've met through the university, and it's a great community. So I'm very fortunate.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your willingness to talk with me and to the whole audience who may view this.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.